Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Corin Shadmi, award-winning illustrator and cartoonist, and we're talking about his latest book, The Twilight Man, Rod Serling and the Birth of Television. Corin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is a pretty brilliant biography. What led you to create a biography of Rod Serling?
Well, I was a latecomer to the Twilight Zone. I was born in Israel, and when I was growing up, there really wasn't very much of the original show. There was only references to it in various media. You know, I heard about it through The Simpsons and Wonder Years and various other, you know, pop culture references, but it never, the original show, for all I know, never really made it to Israel, at least not when I was growing up in the 80s. There was the reboot. And then in the 2000s, around 2009, Netflix put it all on streaming, and I watched the whole thing, and I was just completely blown away. And around that time, I ordered a few biographies of Serling, and I thought, well, maybe he could be a good, interesting guy to make a book about. And, you know, and then when the time came and I was looking for a new project, I took those books down from the shelf and dusted them off and started reading. And I was like, this guy has a great life. Like, let me try and see if I can adapt this.
Well, let me tell you, Corin, I was a kid when they were playing originally. So in the late 50s and 60s. And I can tell you the effect that that show had on people was amazing. And like, if you were in grade school, like I was, it was like the talk of the grade school the next day, everybody was talking about it. And sometimes it just totally freaked you out. It just...
Yeah. When I was reading the biography, you know, people were referring to, you know, kids would stay up late, I guess because it ran kind of late at night.
Right.
And parents would complain that their kids are not going to school and, you know, they're going to school tired because they stayed up late for the Twilight Zone. And they never, I think, anticipated it to be such a hit with kids. You know, and then those are the people that, you know, ended up kind of perpetuating it and making it into a cult show, I think, because it kind of got imprinted in people's minds.
Several of them also gave you nightmares.
Like, I bet, yeah.
Like, I have a beholder, still freaks me out. And some of them about little girl lost rolling underneath the bed and going to another dimension.
Yeah, that one's incredible. No, an incredible episode.
I know. For me, the amazing thing is trying to draw Rod Serling over an extended graphic biography, because he doesn't have really that distinguishing a face. Talk to me about trying to achieve that so that you could actually continue drawing him throughout an entire book.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you do before you start work on a graphic novel. You try to kind of do your own interpretation of you know, kind of comic size or whatever, that word doesn't probably exist, but, you know, turn the character to make it compatible with the comic book so you'd be able to draw him again and again. And
but what did you hook on to? Because he's a pretty plain-looking guy.
He was kind of angular face. He had this interesting bob in his hair. Those are big, big, strong eyebrows. Those things, you know, kind of help. So I think he does have, you know, this distinct, sharp, you know, mid-century look. And then later in the 70s, he kind of grew his hair real big. And, you know, the older he got, the bigger his hair got. And he had these sideburns. So I like that, you know, also changes in context with the time. But yeah, he was a little tricky to draw. But I'm hoping I got him right.
You did. I was amazed. It was pretty surprising. Now, the other thing is his life, and let's talk about his life for a while. Were you surprised about his war experiences? I had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think a lot of people who were creative in that period in mid-century were survivors of, I don't know what to call it, survivors, like veterans and people who basically served in World War II and had shell shock, and that kind of later translated into their work. And when I read about Serling, a lot of things clicked as far as, oh, this makes sense. This is why the Twilight Zone is the way it is.
It is.
He did have, you know, they called it shell shock back then.
And we would call it PTSD today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, back then they really didn't know how to treat it properly. And there was no, I think he went to therapy, but not like consistently and not in a way that was very helpful. And, you know, there wasn't as much research and help back then. So his way of helping himself deal with all these really traumatic memories was to write and to create. And yes, I mean, his war experiences were really shocking, and it was also interesting to learn about, you know, the Pacific Theater you know, the stuff that happened there, because I was mostly, as I think most people are aware, more of the things that happened in Europe and Normandy and things like that. So it was very interesting just to see that there was like this whole other part of the war that he was involved in, and was a big battle, you know, a big battle with a lot of casualties.
It's interesting, as you portray him in his character, he sort of seems hell bent on a lot of things. Like, I have to believe that this stress event is one of the contributing factors to why he died. But he was like hell bent on becoming a paratrooper. Like, he just wouldn't take no for an answer.
Yeah, I think, you know, he was a very, very determined guy, and I think that's also what led him to be successful, because he got through also later in life a lot of rejections and a lot of people say no, till he kept at it. He got better at writing and kept pitching, and finally he got in, and then he made his way up and the TV world, first the radio world, then the TV world. And I think that determination is a big part of his personality. But as you see in the book too, there was a lot of self-questioning and a lot of doubt. And he was a very kind of conflicted person, in one sense, kind of thinking, you know, he's a really great writer and being very confident. And on the other side, kind of thinking he's, you know, no good, or, you know, he's part of a medium that's a lesser medium, because back then TV was, you know, not the was definitely considered lower on the totem pole than film or books. I know for a fact that he wanted to always, like, he really aspired to be more of a writer, more like someone like Norman Miller, you know, like a playwright, and he was really yearning for that respect, which I'm not sure he fully got. You know, he got some of it, but didn't fully get it during his life.
Well, especially during that time period, writers were just considered journeyman workers. Yeah, they may have been really successful, but they didn't think about them, as, especially the public, except he was the host. So you recognized him as the host of the show.
Yeah.
And he would always do these bracketing things, and they were just excellent, like, for your consideration. And then you would go into some weird thing setting up the show, and then he would end it with a little ending thing, which was always great. And it always would end with, and then the Twilight Zone, like this happened in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, this is the thing that's kind of interesting about him, is he was kind of almost like a pitch man, like the guy you would see in Mad Men, you know, and like an ad agency.
Well, and he had that look to him.
Yeah, he had that look. He was going for that look, and he was kind of presenting the show like that, like, you know, let me pitch you this, you know, this ad for, but in reality, he was pitching you nightmares. So it's just like,
well, that's like,
you know, he's this bunned up, you know, corporate looking guy pitching you the most bizarre, surreal
again stuff. You have no idea that, like, imagine those stories coming out when they did, and it was like nothing else you were seeing on TV. And the thing is, it was so many of them were incredibly moralistic too. I mean, there were a lot of anti-war shows.
That comes from his background as a writer, and he was a very progressive guy. And, you know, he did start with shows that were like Playhouse 90.
Well, you know, we should talk about, because most people don't even know. That's the other thing your book does, is it captures a history of the media that I think most people aren't familiar with, but there's what's called the golden age of television. And there were these shows like Playhouse 90, but there's actually a number of them which were sort of anthology shows.
Yeah, it's interesting because now you have the anthology shows coming back a little bit. You have shows like Black Mirror, and I know that the creator of Black Mirror is a big fan of the Twilight Zone. But it was the golden. They call it the golden age of TV because, in a sense, it was really new, and there were no rules yet, and it was more catering to more sophisticated viewers in the coastal cities. And, you know, it was really, they were treating it more like theater. So it's theater for you at home. And that's what these shows were, like Playhouse 90. They would mount these plays live. You would watch it as it was happening. So if anything went wrong, you had to just go with it. And I remember reading about this anecdote about how they shot one show, not a Sterling show, but they shot it and basically someone got wounded during the show, one of the actors, on like a piece of, you know, metal on the stage, and he kept bleeding, and people would just go behind him under the camera and like, you know, clean up all the blood.
He attended Antioch after he got out of the war, and that's where he really honed his writing skills. But the weird stuff that's in your book, like one of the things he did is to earn money was to test experimental parachutes. That sounds like something you would have made up, because that doesn't even sound like a great job. Like, I can't imagine there were people who would go, yeah, you know what I want to do? I want to test experimental parachutes.
Yeah, he really, I mean, you know, that's another part of his personality that, you know, he went to be a paratrooper because that was the most dangerous, the most, you know, daring kind of thing that you could do in the Army. So he, you know, just went for that. And then with the parachutes, he was a paratrooper. So when he was out of school, that was his way of making money. It was like, well, I'm a paratrooper. I, you know, better make use of it. And then he tested some contraptions that killed other people. So it was very, you know, really kind of a daredevil thing to do. And I'm happy he survived to actually make all those great shows. So.
He, where did he meet his wife, Carol?
It's in college, I believe, in Antioch.
And she was with him for his entire life?
Yeah, she was, yeah. She actually, I think, just died this year. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And it's amazing what she put up with, because initially he was having major PTSD episodes. He'd wake up screaming, and he would actually have some waking ones where he thought he was back in the war, too.
Yeah, as far as I know, he suffered from that his whole life. And again, it's just, you know, back then it was just like, you know, you tough it up. You know, the way to deal with it was drinking and smoking.
That's right.
That's what he did. And then it's not necessarily the best thing for you. And,
no.
You know, probably why he died so young.
It's always shocking nowadays to see somebody who's hosting a show every week smoking while they're hosting the show. And the cigarette was ever present when he was on the in front of the screen.
Yeah, cigarettes were, you know, it was a big deal then. And then, you know, you still see that was when I was doing research for the book, and I was looking at some advertising from the period, and you could see ads for cigarettes, and they're endorsed by doctors.
Oh yeah,
doctors,
oh yeah,
endorsing them. And you know, it was a very different time. Doctors would smoke
in their office while they were talking to you.
Right. Yeah. It's just completely different period. But
so
yeah, I tried to kind of put that in. And if you look in the book, I would say probably 70% of the frames he's holding a cigarette or smoking a cigarette. So.
My guest tonight is Corinne Chaudmi. award-winning illustrator and cartoonist. And we've been talking about his latest book, The Twilight Man, Rod Serling and the Birth of Television. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. My name is Mark Lynch. One of the other things that's sort of cool is you stick characters from The Twilight Zone just in the corners of things and all over throughout the entire book.
Yeah. I tried to, make it... That's the thing that was tricky, is that I knew that a lot of Twilight Zone fans would be reading this.
Yeah.
So I wanted to put little Easter eggs for them so they can recognize in the background. But at the same time, his life story is bigger than the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and that's what you'll get from reading this book. You'll understand it. That was an important segment of it, but he did a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, I think that the book is like maybe a third Twilight Zone, and so there's so many good episodes, there's so many good anecdotes, and I really couldn't fit it all in there. So, when I could, I would, if there was a scene happening, like there's a scene where he's confronted by Charles Beaumont, who was one of the writers on the Twilight Zone, and in the background, it's the episode where I'm blanking out the name, but with this kind of dictator child who has God powers, and that's I put little bits from that episode.
That's Billy Mumy from Lost in Space playing It's a Good Life or something like that.
It's a Good Life. Yes.
That's where you wish it out into the cornfield.
Yeah. It's, it was, yeah, I mean, I saw this as an adult, and it was terrifying to me.
But I'll tell you, you know what happened when you saw it as a kid? You said, I want that.
Yeah.
If you were like a 7, 8, 10-year-old and you watched that episode had a totally different effect of you. You kept like going outside and going like, trying to make it work.
Yeah, I wish I could turn my teacher into...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Teacher, your parents... You wanted to be able to do that thing with the Jack in the Box. Getting back to when he was originally writing in teleplays, his first big success was this teleplay called Patterns. What do you know about that? Because I've never seen that.
Patterns, you can actually see it on YouTube, I believe. There's several versions of it. There's a version that was made into a film, and there's the original version. That was broadcast on TV, and it was a corporate drama. It was basically, about the corporate world, set in New York, and about how ruthless it is, and how out with the old, in with the new, and how there's really no, there's not enough humanity in companies and in the corporate world, and it was like a social commentary, basically.
That ended up being a Twilight Zone episode too. The one about the guy who keeps dreaming on his train going to work that he gets off at this, it's Wilburville or something like that, and he ends
Willoughby,
up it's the, Willoughby. It's next stop Willoughby, but the work environment is totally horrible. It's like push, and it's very dog eat dog. And very not a great place to live. And this guy sort of escapes into the fantasy world, which ends up being the name of the funeral home that picks up his body.
Yeah, there's echoes of that in a lot of his work. And that was his life. He was kind of for a while, at least he was like a corporate guy. He was working on radio at radio station. And, he lived that life. Later, when he was writing The Twilight Zone, it was more like, he was by the pool. Dictating the episodes into his dictaphone, so it really wasn't his life the whole time around. But that was definitely, I think, something that he could get. He had first person experience on.
Well, he tried to write a play about Emmett Till, the Emmett Till case, and as you recount, we won't talk about all the details. So he recounts this very famous story of racial hatred. And it gets severely cut and changed by the broadcast station people. And that sort of taught him a huge lesson. And what he realized is maybe if he did it as a science fiction story, he could get away with it.
Yeah, that is kind of the origin, the kernel of what ended up being the Twilight Zone, is because he was battling censorship and advertisers and networks, and he was kind of sick and tired of them messing around with his work, and he knew better on how to create a good story. And then so he was like, well, if I disguise this social commentary, instead of people in the court, I put robots, and instead of in Baltimore, I'll set it in on Mars, then no one, these people are not going to be smart enough to understand that this is social commentary. And he was right. He had 100% creative control, and no one changed anything.
There's still, once the Twilight Zone got going, there was still initially from stations, there were, because not all episodes ended well or ended happy. And there was a lot of tension around that. And you tell a great anecdote. It was being produced by Desi Lu Productions with Desi Arnaz. And Desi Arnaz actually was the one that said, nah, I like it, so let's keep it.
Yeah, that's the story of the, you could call it today, the pilot of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, it ran as an episode of the Desi Lu show, which was, Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball. And they had their own kind of weekly show. And it got a lot of pushback. They really didn't, the network didn't like it. The advertisers didn't like it. It was an episode about, if someone was going back in time and he knew that Pearl Harbor happened and he tried to warn everybody, but no one listened to him. They thought the viewers weren't smart enough to understand
That's right.
The concept of time travel and all these other things. And they were wrong. It was a big hit. So that set the stage for the Twilight Zone being greenlit.
Looking at the show today, it's amazing the writers that he attracted. I mean, initially he tried to do everything. Initially he tried to direct the episodes, write the episodes, host the episodes. The only thing he didn't do was he was never in the episode. But eventually he had to farm it out to other writers. And he got people who were very well known for writing unusual things. Chuck Beaumont, Buck Houghton, and Richard Matheson are three of them, who wrote some of the best episodes of the entire series.
Yeah, Buck Houghton or Houghton, I'm not sure how to pronounce
I think it's
his
Houghton.
Name. He was the producer. But Chuck Beaumont and Matheson were these very distinguished science fiction writers. And Serling was smart enough to not just get just these, local Hollywood hacks, but go into the place where there were experts, the people who knew what they're writing about. And then these people basically took some of their own stories and then you saw them translated into short films in the Twilight Zone. And some of the best episodes are written by these two guys. And so it's worth, if you're a science fiction buff, it's worth reading. Beaumont only has, he died pretty young, so he only has short stories, but Matheson has a bunch of really good stories, including The Omega Man.
That's right, which was made into umpteen number of films.
Yeah, many, many movies.
Did he also write the movie that was the film Psycho was based on? I'm not sure if he did that.
I don't know. But
I think one of them did. But Matheson has written a lot of stuff that's lasted. What was amazing is the series was developing a real hardcore following, but then this guy came into the studio, James Aubrey, the Smiling Cobra, who just decided to cut everything and gave him virtually no budget.
Yeah, that's reflecting the what I was talking about earlier about how TV was becoming this more popular medium, and all of a sudden they had to appeal to a bigger viewership, and they're in them everywhere. They weren't just in the coast, and they had to make shows that were just kind of more fun and stupid and appeal to everybody, like Gilligan's Island. And he really didn't like the Twilight Zone. He really didn't like shows like Playhouse 90, he thought they were, you know, just expensive, and he just was thinking about the bottom line. And it's interesting that only in the past 20 years we're kind of getting back to what Serling was aiming for.
That's right.
With shows like The Sopranos that started, like, you know, the new golden age of television, where now TV is, you know, you can create something for TV that's just as respected as a film.
Yeah, he ended up, the series ended, and he tried to make a comeback with a series called Night Gallery, which I don't think a lot of people remember. I remember it well, which didn't last that long. It was introduced, you'd see some paintings, and each painting had a, you know, had to do with whatever the segment was. But that never really caught on, and the writing and the production of it was not that great.
Yeah, the Night Gallery, I mean, again, I was trying to dive into it while I was working on the book, and I really can't say that I connected with it. I was looking best Night Gallery episodes, and even the best are kind of awful. But the truth is, it was part of it was because Serling wasn't the creative force behind it anymore. He was just hired as sort of the presenter, and sometimes every once in a while, you know, they would let him write something, but they really didn't give him, you know, he wasn't at the helm anymore. He wasn't driving the ship. He was just there as like a guest, and it shows what happens when, you know, the wrong people are in control of the show. It just doesn't come out as well.
We're completely out of time. I just want to mention he died of his heart condition. And you just really get the feeling from reading your book that it was the stress of the thing. He was always pushing himself no matter what. Even when he went Hollywood, he was always pushing himself. And it's really, he was a force to be reckoned with. I mean, things like the Requiem for a Heavyweight, which is one of the other plays that he wrote, are still, they last, and they were really, really good. Well, I want to thank you. My guest tonight has been, let me just get this up here, Corinne Chadmi, award-winning illustrator and cartoonist. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's really well done, and I'm not even going to give away one of the interesting aspects of this book, so we won't talk about that. But his latest book is The Twilight Man, Rod Serling and the Birth of Television. Corinne, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.